Hello, and welcome to the Off the Table podcast. We are a group of global health enthusiasts from diverse backgrounds who deeply care about improving access to surgery worldwide and believe that the solutions come from the ground up. Your hosts, Amuna, Reem, Paul, and myself, Emily, will aim to create a safe environment to have comfortable and uncomfortable conversations about equitable surgery. We aim to be impactful by sending a concrete and evidence-based call to action after each conversation. We truly hope you enjoy these conversations as much as we do. Welcome, everyone, and thank you for tuning in. On our first episode of the Off the Table podcast, we are thrilled to have Dr. Emmanuel Mekasa, an orthopedic surgeon from Zambia, global health diplomat, and champion of surgical care. Good afternoon, Dr. Mekasa, and thank you for joining us from Zambia.
Good afternoon, Emily, and good afternoon, everybody else who's listening into the podcast. Pleasure to be here.
All right. We are going to start it off by asking you to tell us a little bit more about you, where you grew up, and how did you become, or why did you become a surgeon?
Okay. So I was born and raised in the Republic of Zambia, which is in the southern part of Africa, bordering the border between Southern Africa and Central Africa. So we are right below the Congo and above Zimbabwe. And yeah, I was born here. I went to school in the northwestern part of the country, bordering Angola and Congo DR. I did all my education here, primary school and high school. And then I went to the University of Zambia. I initially wanted to be an engineer. Somehow, in the early days of university, I switched my program to medicine and graduated from the University of Zambia School of Medicine in the year 2000. And then at the time, everybody was leaving the continent. Most of my colleagues, everybody really wanted to go. As soon as you finish university, you wanted to go somewhere else. And I was undecided. And so I decided to start my postgraduate training while I was trying to decide what to do with my life. Again, in medicine, I wanted to be a pediatrician, because I love working with children. I think they inspire me all the time. But there were too many. After doing my internship in PEDS, there were just too many kids, and I realized I needed time for me, so I left PEDS. Next, I went to Obs and Gyne. I was always fascinated by pregnant women. Somehow, they make me want to take care of them. So I wanted to do Obs and Gyne. I did a year in obstetrics and gynecology. I couldn't sit there either because, well, the women delivered anytime, and I couldn't do that. I needed to control my life and arrange my life. So I left. I went into surgery. I loved surgery. Not every surgery. So I found orthopedics and trauma. I'm okay with blood and everything else. And so I chose orthopedics and trauma. And then I specialized in orthopedics and trauma from 2003 to 2007. At the end of my training, I felt like I didn't have enough research skills, because the academic program didn't really teach us very much, yet we were supposed to do dissertations and stuff like that. So I put my program on hold. I got a Fulbright scholarship and came to the United States. I did my master's in public health, focused on global health epidemiology. So I did that, and then I came back, finished my program here, and I stayed on. I was quickly moved into the Ministry of Health after a year or so of working as a senior registrar, because I had both clinical and public health skills. And so I was deputy director in the Ministry of Health, responsible for setting up emergency health services in the country. I was only in my position for like 6 months from being appointed to confirmation. And then I was sent out to Geneva to head the health desk at the permanent mission of the Republic of Zambia to the United Nations. So I went to Geneva from 2012 until 2017, working as a diplomat, covering everything in health, so dealing with WHO, Global Fund, UNICEF, and all that jazz, both state and non-state actors. And of course, that was the bilateral mission to the Swiss Confederate. I was there, like I said, up to 2017. We did a lot of global surgery work at the UN. And then I came back to the Republic of Zambia in 2017. I worked under the Office of the President for 2 years, mostly advising on health in all policies. And then I was back in the Ministry of Health at the beginning of 2020 when the COVID was just hitting. And then I was sent back to my primary site, which is the University Teaching Hospital, where I am now. So I'm a consultant orthopedic and trauma surgeon here, but I do academic work. I also consult for a lot of other entities. I coordinate a lot of work for SADC, and I teach. That's a little bit about me.
It's amazing. What an amazing career so far. What would you say if we were to ask you, what's your favorite part about your career thus far, or your favorite part about your job? What would it be?
I think the favorite part is really seeing that what you do has effect, you know, seeing the outcomes of what you are putting in really is the favorite part. And that's why I like to work with children, because even in orthopedics and trauma, I'm still more likely to work with children, because kids have an amazing capacity of, you know, survival and even healing, even trying. So when I work with them, first of all, the impact of what I do is very visible in children, because they are growing people and they try. That, for me, is really what gets you going. If you are not seeing the results of what you're doing, yeah, it's very hard to remain sustained in your efforts. So for me, that part is most the best in whatever I do. If I can see the results of what I'm doing, then that's good.
That's amazing. Yeah. I see we have a lot of children enthusiasts on this podcast.
Cool, yes.
I'll shift gears a little bit, Emmanuel, and I would like to talk about National Surgical Obstetrics and Anesthesia Plans. And I thought you'd be a really good person to explain briefly what that means and why these plans were created and the need for them in LMICs.
Okay, so the fact that the surgical services are not very good, especially in low middle income countries, even in some developed countries in the rural areas, it's not magic. Everybody or most of the people should know that. If they don't, well, really, health systems are not very good in terms of saving those that are in the periphery or those that are really poor, because they're the ones actually who live in the periphery. For us, it's almost a national picture, because except those who live in the cities and in along the line of rail, the rest of the population really don't really have access. So I'll explain it from how I came to be involved in all this and also to explain the term. For us as a country, when I worked in the, first of all, I'm a surgeon, so I've been working in the surgical field. And in our training, we had to fly, or we did outreach from the capital to the periphery, because the country is big. It's 750,000 square kilometers, so it's huge. And the people can't always find their way to the orthopedic services. Our surgical services mostly are only in the tertiary and secondary level hospitals. So that's like far away from the people. And so anybody with a surgical disease had to be referred. They come late. You know all that story about people presenting late and the disease is really progressed. What we did with orthopedics is that there was a program set up in Zambia from 1982 called FlySpec. So we have two single engine aircrafts. We fly as surgeons together with plastic surgery teams to outreach and save those periphery places. So from that experience, which was what I did throughout my training, I had a first-time experience of the plight of the rural areas. But anyway, in 2010, we were under the MDGs. And at a certain time, one of the targets, as you know, in the MDGs was to try and reduce maternal mortality. So we did an assessment as a country in 2010 to see if we're going to meet the MDG goals, one of which was the maternal mortality issue. When that assessment was done, it was very clear that Zambia was not going to reach the MDGs. And one of the key things that was killing mothers around childbirth was to do with bleeding. And the solution really that was to be instituted was surgical capacity. There was no surgery going on at the district hospital. So imagine having to transfer a mother who's in second stage of labor over 1,000 kilometers. It's just impossible. It's just unbelievable. So when I was going to the United Nations in Geneva in 2012, one of the missions I had was to try and work out, because we didn't have a way of how we're going to improve surgical capacity. We knew it was lacking. So that MDG assessment gave us that report. But there was also another report that was done by a Fulbright scholar. We had a Fulbright scholar that came from the United States called Dr. Kendra Bowman from Harvard. And she was interested to know the surgical capacity of all health facilities. So we flew around with her. We took out all the facilities. She did a research and an assessment to see what capacity each facility could provide in terms of surgical services. Even that report indicated huge gaps in our health services. So How do we improve then? Because we have two reports. How do we improve surgical capacity? We didn't have any way to do it. We looked around at stakeholders and partners that could help normally, like WHO. And WHO country office had nothing, not even a person working on surgical healthcare. The same was the story with the regional office in Brazzaville. So we didn't know, we couldn't do it. So when I was going to Geneva, first of me as an advocate and a person working in surgery and wanting to improve the services, because I was working also in the rural areas, it was my personal mission to try and do something. But my government also gave me this mandate that I should explore at WHO in Geneva, how we could work with them to help improve surgical capacity through some kind of formulation of a policy. When I went to Geneva, I found Dr. Mina Cherian. She was the only one working in the surgical space. And yes, there was nothing there either really that could support us, not even a resolution. So we started working with that person, the focal point in WHO, and also working with the different other member states of Southern Africa or SADC, to try and see if we can bring forth a resolution that would help us as a building point from which we can build a policy or through WHO that could then we can use to help our countries to formulate the policy and then the programs and then the service. So we started mobilizing and negotiating for the resolution, and that was totally independent of anything else that was going by. I had no clue that there was a Lancet Commission. I had no clue that there was a DCP3 publication. I had the mandate from my government and I was working with the member states and we were moving forward. It was until we had taken the resolution all through, you know, the executive board, and it was now going to the World Health Assembly sometime in, I think, April of 2015, when I was invited by the Lancet Commission to come and join the Lancet Commission on Global Surgery during their last sitting, which was taking place in Bellagio in Italy. So I went to the commission and I was sitting there, and the meeting was mostly to talk about what they were going to do with the report, because they had already done the report. Everything was there. And then the commission usually ends after the report is published. But the commissioners, I think, were interested to see how they can carry this work forward. And so while I was with them, and I was looking at how, because the resolution was almost complete, because by the time it goes through the EB, we have consensus. Everybody has agreed to the text, to everything that's in there. And for me, like I said, the government mandate was just not to get the resolution and forget about it. It was once we have the resolution, that's what we use to build on to what we do next. So I was looking for something of what we can use to do next. The Lashen commissioners were looking at something that they could use to take this report forward. And so at the meeting, they showed me through the documents that they had, one of the things that was in the report was the framework. There were the five key messages, but there was also a framework of how they thought countries could take the work forward. And so for me, that was a great opportunity. Here is something that was, okay, it was theoretical, but it was something that had been developed with good, you know, input and technical, you know, know-how. And WHO did not have anything that we could use. And so we looked at this as something that we could look at. And so while we were in the meeting, I did contact my ministry about that opportunity. Could we try this? Could we use this to try and go forward? And they said yes now. So the framing of the National Surgical Obstetric Anesthesia Plan comes from the Lancet Commission on Global Surgery. That's where that framework is. It's an academic product produced by the Lancet Commission. Now we took it on as a government, the first government, because we wanted to work with something and there was nobody else that had anything like that. WHO even up to now didn't have anything that you can use to guide on developing surgical policy at country level. So then we took that down to the Republic of Zambia, used it to try and create our own national surgical, and we named it as such because already there was a framework and a name. So that's how come that name comes in, National Surgical Obstetric Anesthesia Plan, because really surgery, as you know, really covers obstetrics and anesthesia are key components, and we had no problems with that. And so the first policy that we developed here with the help of the Harvard PGSSC team, who are led by John Mira, who was a Lancet commissioner, I think he was a chair, we then developed the first National Surgical Obstetric Anesthesia Plan. When that happened, of course, a lot of other countries who had also committed to the resolution, who wanted to do something about surgical capacity, also were looking at improving that. So together with the advocacy from the global surgery family, and an example of what Zambia had done, then we started moving this agenda faster and faster and faster, and a lot of other countries started taking it on. They've taken it on, but not everybody has gotten to the point of developing a policy. And so anyway, this is the history of where the National Surgical Obstetric Anesthesia Plan comes from. It comes from the Lancet Commission on Global Surgery Framework and that report. But we customized it because it's really aligned. It's strange, but it was the resolution and everything else. If you look at the World Bank publication, if you look at the Lancet Commission report, and you look at the resolution, they are very, very aligned because we're talking technically the same things.
I think it's fascinating how we actually basically translated policy into action. I feel like if you hadn't sat at that table, that this would never have been, you know, translated into an NSOAP. So really, thank you for creating that first one. I wanted to follow up with the question about how do you feel that that first plan created by Zambia influenced the rest of the NSOAP creation all across? Because I know there's a lot of plans being written in sub-Saharan Africa and other countries as well. How do you feel that Zambia has been a leader in supporting NSOAPs in other countries?
Yeah, so once we created that policy, we had to be an example. We had to share best practice in diplomacy and in country intergovernmental relations. There's always sharing of how are you sorting this problem. So both within WHO, within the WHO Afro region, and within SADC, we deal with these challenges together. And so for us, we didn't just want to be the only ones. We wanted to share our best practice with everybody else. And everybody else was interested anyway from what they had done, because before a country can support anything at the WHO or at the UN, they have to check within their background, is it really something worth their while? Is it going to help them? So they know they may not have a baseline data that they can give you, but generally from experience, they would know if that is a problem. So they were already interested. And so it was mandatory that we would share our experience of how did we translate our political commitment through a resolution into a policy at country level that we had developed ourselves, of course, with support from outside and customizing a framework that was developed for the global picture, but now to the country. And then we ourselves, I think personally, were very interested in ensuring that we continue and stay engaged in global strategy discussions. So we took this discussion everywhere to explain how did it happen. Because until a country formulates a policy out of a political commitment, nothing really happens at country level. As you know, there are many World Health Assembly resolutions or UN resolutions. They are gathering dust. Nothing has been done about them. Very few of them actually get translated into anything on the ground. Even with the surgical commitment, we're still struggling. The countries have bought into it. It's really incorporated into the UHC agenda, even at the UN, even in the declaration that came out of the high-level meeting in New York. Surgery is recognized. But then we still struggle at the ground in terms of financing it. Many people still don't understand it because it's cross-cutting. Surgery is not in one place. There is surgery in PEDS, in OBS and gynae, in geriatrics, in palliative care. It's everywhere. It's throughout the age group. So sometimes it's just that people don't understand. And then we ourselves who work in the surgical space as surgeons, we're kind of big-headed in our little theaters. We want everything to work, but we don't really get out of that theater to engage. You know, yes, we do a bit of academics in terms of research instead of teaching, but do we go and sit at the policy-making table? Do we engage the politicians, the funders? That we've never done, and most of the time we don't.
That's actually a perfect segue into the next question that we wanted to ask you, because as you mentioned, a lot of these, the results from commissions in the WHO or at different levels, like you said, gather dust. Who, in your opinion, who should we hold accountable to uphold the results of these commissions to be translated into actionable items on the ground, as you mentioned? In your opinion, how can that be done? Or who can be held accountable?
I think two entities can be held accountable for this. First is the national governments themselves. The population should be interested in what their governments are really committing to at the UN, because that's the club where everybody comes to show or be nice or, you know, or actually commit to really problems that are on the ground. But it's turning out to be a show where we say we agree, we endorse something, we sign up for it, but we do nothing when we come. Nothing really is translated until somebody, even when it's forced onto them, it's resisted. It's amazing that something that was unanimously supported when we go to countries, they say, yeah, it's a priority, but you know what I'm saying? So the governments themselves, the people have to hold their governments accountable for what they are committing to at the UN or at WHO. And then the WHO itself has a mandate, because if you look at the resolution, it has two parts. There's the preambular paragraph framing the whole picture of whatever it is that we're trying to sort out. And then it comes to the operative paragraphs that actually tell us what the governments are going to do. So there is what the member states are urged to do. If you look at Resolution 6815, it clearly says what the countries are committing to do. And that is negotiated. It's not something we just inserted for them so that they go and do it. They sat on the table with all of us, and we went through every text, every comma, everything there. They approved themselves as countries that they were going to do it. And they never approve anything that's outside their capacity to do. So they should be held accountable for what they've committed to do. The second component is the mandate that we give to WHO. WHO cannot be a lead organization in health if it's not doing what it's supposed to be doing. WHO is not about us coming to Geneva to come and play there, eat pizza and talk nonsense, and then come back to the ground doing nothing. WHO should be effective on the ground. So there are certain components also that are given to WHO in the resolution, in the operative paragraph. You see, they'll urge the WHO through the DG to do A, B, C, and D. So WHO should be seen to do that. It has the mechanisms and framework and partners that can help it do that. So for me, those two are the two entities that should be held accountable. And all of us, the global surgery movement, the population themselves who are the one to receive this service, and the NGO, any civil society, should actually be interested and follow up these things. They should make it a political issue. They should make it a voting issue, at least for the countries.
How do we feel we can better engage patients, populations, you know, the actual direct recipients of that care into those plans and this accountability system? Because I feel like you said, surgery is cross-cutting. Anyone could benefit from surgery from any different, you know, types of disease that they may have. Like, how can we better engage patients, populations? I feel like this would be like a mass movement pushing towards better access to surgical care. And I haven't really felt that through building of those ENSOPs or even through the Lancet Commission.
Yes. So that's a key part of global surgery or the global surgery movement that all of us who are working in global surgery should actually consider. The last 5 years, we've spent mostly talking to ourselves and talking to the key stakeholders, so to say. So we talk to WHO, we talk to the UN, we try to talk to funding agencies, CEDAR, USAID, DFID, European Investment Bank, and things like that. And then we tweet, we follow each other. And then we go to global surgery conferences before COVID, at least. We went there, we talked about the problem, And most of the time, we like to talk about the problem. We like to describe the problem. Rarely do we actually come up with solutions. Now, that has to change, because so far we are all convinced. Oh, we all know. But still, nothing really is happening. And even if we did get something to be done, it goes two ways. We are creating the capacity, but we need to create the demand. The demand is there, but it also, there's a picture that we need to paint properly. Do the people really know what surgical disease is? If I went out in the community and found somebody with a condition and asked them, how do you think, or who should treat this? How do you think it's treatable? The people won't know how, if that is actually a surgical condition. So there's need for us to educate the population, first of all, on surgical disease. What are the surgical diseases that they have? You know what I'm saying? So that they know that what they have could be managed, could be treated, or at least it shouldn't be so bad. Because as you know, most of the surgical conditions are physically debilitating. It causes some kind of disability. And so it encroaches on their economic output. So first of all, we need to educate them. And then there's also misconceptions about surgery. What do the people feel about surgery? Is it okay for them? What I know is that most of them are scared. They're dead scared of surgery. Why are they scared of surgery? Are we checking why they're scared? Off my head, maybe the outcomes that they've seen from surgery have been bad. Maybe the process of going through surgery has been traumatic. Maybe it's the pain. We didn't manage the pain properly, as you know. Or, you know what I'm saying? People who are with no skill, using wrong equipment, did wrong surgery, and it ended up with a death or a bad outcome. We have to manage that as well. And again, even just other stakeholders, just not the patient, what do they understand about surgery? People know that, well, there's a bleeding person, he goes in through a door and he comes back with a bandage. They don't have a clue what really happens there. Can we demystify surgery? Okay, we have to demystify surgery, and then we have to explain how surgery really helps the people. Besides addressing their concerns and their worries and their myths and their beliefs, we also have to explain to them, how does it really help you? If I have a hernia, middle-aged as I am, I cannot grow my food. If I can't grow my food because I've got this abdominal hernia, then I'll have no food security at home. If I have no food security and I can't even have any surplus, so I can't sell, so I'll have no money. If I have no money, I can't send my kids to school. The reaction keeps going on and on and on and on. So we have to also explain to the people how surgery could help them with many of the health problems they are facing. Nobody wants their mother to die when they're giving birth to their little sister. And like we know, most of the deaths are coming because of bleeding, some kind of bleeding. You can't stop bleeding with paracetamol. You need to intervene surgically. So we have to explain to the people so they appreciate, understand surgery. We also understand their concerns and needs, so that whatever capacity we are building is also supported. Plus, we who work in the global surgery movement, at least in the low middle income countries, most of us work for public institutions. We work for governments. Ethically and politically and professionally, there are certain things that we can't say. There are certain things that I cannot say, even to the population, even if I know. Now, we need to empower the population so that they can advocate and demand what they deserve themselves from whoever is supposed to provide it. There are NGOs that are mobilizing a lot of money around the world, and where are they taking it? It's not going in the right places. There are governments that have got collecting taxes and a lot of other things, and they're not putting it where they need it. But like we said, surgery is a magic bullet. It solves a lot of things in the health system, in the health of the people. So let's empower the people with the knowledge, all the knowledge, so that they can, and the tools of engagement, so they can demand these things from their politicians. Maybe it's a local government, maybe it's local government at municipal level, maybe it's a constituency or national level. If the people demand it and they make it an election issue, we are not going to vote for you until you can provide surgical services for us at our local district hospital. And for us in the global surgery movement, besides engaging them through the civil society, because how do we engage them? Okay, like we have to advocate to the people, but we have to work out new ways of engaging them. There is civil society organization that work with the communities. Can we partner with them? Can we work with them? Can they look at this as a big issue? Public health experts, they do a lot of research, they do a lot of publication, but now nobody is looking at the surgical component. So health economists are busy talking health economics, but have you analyzed the impact of surgery on the population? We could predict the health costs and a lot of other things, but we should also look at the positive aspects of surgery. We shouldn't just print a big picture. Surgery is expensive, or it needs specialized equipment, trained staff, and the burden is this big. That's what we talk about in global surgery. You know? We're always painting the picture of the problem. Can we change it and also start talking about how we can solve the problem with surgery? If we operated on you, how does it change your life? As a family, as an individual, as a community. Okay, let's frame it positive about how much you're losing economically because you can't work, because you have a surgical condition. That some people have done already. There are many studies that you can look at. But what about the other side? Once I do surgery on you, how economically productive do you get to be? Those are the kind of things that governments want to hear. Those are the things that populations want to hear, the positive aspects of something, an intervention. So let's print also, let's write not only, like I said, let's not only publish in journals that we read. It's useless. We're talking to ourselves. Let's publish in Newsweek. Let's publish in magazines for travel. Let's write in newspapers every day. Let's write for the people, not for our experts, so they get to know what's up.
I feel like as much as we need to take the surgeon out of the operating room, like you said, to become an advocate for surgical care, I think we need to bring the people in the operating room. Like
exactly.
Some part
we need
of like
bring
what you
the people, yes.
they need to demystify, they need to know that this will, you know, this will help them. This is not some magical thing that's happening in a room that's cold and full of people with masks and
yeah, only for the privileged. No,
exactly. I really think we should level the playing field and make sure that this is accessible to everyone, like even like physically accessible, and so it doesn't remain hidden in a corner. And I think surgeons historically have been very protective of that operating room environment. You know, it's like a little castle for us, and I think we need to be able to step out of this zone and be able to advocate for our own patients, but that patients would be able to actually see what's going on in there too. You talk a lot about a district hospital, and I read your tweet, more doing less acting in global surgery. When are we testing the district surgical health system model? And actually, one of the targets of the Zambia NSOAP is to have access to surgical care in 100% of district hospitals by 2021. We are now in 2021. Can you tell us what the goal and the progress has been towards this goal in practical terms, if you know?
Yeah, we can give you that. We were committed to do that, but obviously, again, it's not always possible to do everything as you planned it. Rarely do you actually, your plans come out the way you want, even if no matter how simple the plan is, it's rare that it will turn out just the way you planned it. So when we made that surgical plan, we were still in the process of building a lot of district hospitals. I think we hadn't even completed. And then there was also a lot of processes that were going on in that some provinces or state. Some of them have specific number of districts, but some of the districts were really big. So government was already partitioning some of the districts to create new districts. So we have more districts now than we had. And government spent most of the last 5 years really building a lot of capacity by building the actual heavy duty staff, which nobody's going to finance, the buildings, the facilities, and then also trying to stock up those facilities with some equipment. We can't say that every facility has an equipment. And then there's also the need to actually create a program, because once you have a policy in place, it's not automatic that the policy translates into service. There has to be a program to provide the service. Now, creating the program needs financing. We as a country did everything that we could in terms of higher level staff. So we developed the National Surgical Obstetric Anesthesia Plan. This plan was incorporated already in the health sector strategy. So it was prioritized. And what we wanted to achieve is clearly spelled out in the health sector strategy. So don't look at the plan, the National Surgical Plan. Look at the health sector strategy, which actually picked out things that we were to implement. Yeah, and then that then is supposed to be financed through whether local financing or a partnership with a donor or private sector to actually then roll it out into service delivery. So we did a lot of heavy lifting. I don't think we've succeeded in providing surgical care to every district hospital, no. We have not done an assessment. It was being done. There was a midterm and end of policy assessment. I don't have the fine details yet of how much we've gone. But I know that we're still a little bit far. And then also the surgical services have to be provided. Usually here we provide them through different cadres. It could be a surgeon, it could be a doctor, just a doctor who has surgical skills or has picked up skills. Because when you work in the rural areas or in the district, you have to do something. You have to do something. You can't say, I'm not specialized, I'm not, you're a doctor. You have to do something. So even our students, when we train them, we do train them with some certain skills. And at least a C-section is something that they should do when they do their internship before they go out, because we expect them to do that. But there are other things that we have to do if we're really going to be able to provide surgery at the district hospital, in the sense that we may have to change our establishment. Establishment is basically the structure of what human resources you should have in this particular facility. I think our establishment so far still does not allow a surgeon to be placed at the district hospital. There's no position for a surgeon at the district hospital. So if there is no position for a surgeon, even if I wanted to go to the district, I can't, because there's no space for me there. So there's still other things that we have to work on. We've done, like I said, the heavy lifting. We've worked improving capacity in the tertiary and secondary level facilities. Most of them have become training grounds, so we have registrars there. Our goal now, as we try to renew this plan, will be the district. Even then, I don't think we're going to reach every district at once, because you see, this is innovative. It's new. We have to try. The pilot that I'm talking about is that we already have plans. We already want to do something at the district. But overall, We have struggled in the last 5 years. I'll go back, then I'll get back to this point so you understand. We've struggled to try and get financing for surgical healthcare from anyone. Okay? Why? Somehow, maybe because we don't have the evidence. We understand, they don't. You know, a development guy who did development studies, he doesn't understand surgery and how it impacts anybody. There's no data, there's no record. Now, for us, what we feel now, after having worked in advocacy for so long and struggling to get any finance going, we feel that we should learn from other people. I will use HIV. When HIV was a problem in Southern Africa or in the world, and somebody came up with antiretroviral medication, nobody really knew that they could work. It was until somebody sneaked out with some ARVs and went to Haiti and tested them on HIV patients and saw the reaction and the response and the improvement and documented that. And then came and shared, hey, this is what happens when we use these medications like this. There was evidence, and then people bought into that because there were results. And then they started scaling that up slowly. Slowly, it was never boom, everywhere you have ART. No, it doesn't work like that. The same thing should happen with surgery. We know we need surgery, but we need to go to a district and set up a health system that includes surgical capacity. It's not just the facility. It has to outreach the clinics and to the community. It's pre-hospital care, hospital care, and then post-hospital care. All that should be nicely set up in one district. And then we can ensure that we can provide emergency and essential surgical care 24/7 and document everything that we're doing for a year or for 6 months. So then we look at what's happening to the health system strengthening, because everybody wants to strengthen health systems in the world. It's always on everybody's lips. But how do you do it, actually? Nobody can tell you that. I'm telling you, we can do it through surgical care. But let's set it up and see and have the record and the evidence that surgical capacity building at the district hospital can strengthen the health system. Theoretically, we can explain how. But practically, let's have the evidence. And then we're saying surgery can improve health outcomes across the board, across the life course. Again, this is something we have to document. Can we show how surgery is going to support the improvement of health outcomes where it's stagnated? We know the maternal mortality in that district has been like that for 3, 4, 5 years or 10 years. When we improve surgical capacity, let's see how it's going to change. How it's going to change. Everybody wants to reduce maternal mortality. And then the socioeconomic part of it, like I said, we improve the health system, we improve the health outcome, but how does it improve the socioeconomics of the individual, of the family? Those are the things that I was talking about, saying, let's have a surgical patient who's struggling because they've got a discondition. We operate on them. And then let's monitor how they become economically productive after recovery from that operation. That is something that everybody wants to know. When we have those results in those three areas, I don't think people are going to stop or refuse to finance surgical healthcare. And we're also going to learn lessons. So we'll have the evidence, and we'll have lessons on how it can be done, because we still have to set it up. We still have to learn on what's functioning, what's not working. And then using all that, then we can share this as best practice for anybody who can finance surgery, for governments, for everybody else. It's the last piece. If we keep talking, we'll talk forever. Some of us are sick and tired of talking anymore. We want action. We want to do something on the ground.
We do need to tell compelling stories. I love this idea. I think that's great. But my question is, in terms of monitoring those outcomes, like how and who collects this data so that you're able to see, you know, where the surgical care is in Zambia? Can you tell us a little bit more about that? Because I know that's one of the obstacles also to do work like that, like data collection and outcome measurement.
Yeah, so surgical information is usually left out of the information health management systems in many countries. Surgical data is not there. But you know, all the time when a patient presents to the facility, there's a record. Every time a patient goes to theater, we write as surgeons, mail, what we did. We have information. That some of that information stays in the theater, and we write in books. After 5 years, there will be 5, 6 books, which will be stored in some place. And then we need the storage. Oh, this is from 1980. Throw it away. It goes away. That's data. So there are problems with the data systems, yes. And we've tried to innovate with how we can improve data systems, even in the community. Here we've piloted the DHS, the demographic health survey, to include some kind of surgical information. We did that, but it's not really comprehensive. I think that this pilot I talk about has to be some kind of a project with strong partnership from the Ministry of Health as the owners of the system, but also from academic institutions that are involved in global surgery. It has to be some kind of a research. So we'll have to set up systems. We have to work out systems that will be the best because it's multi-sectoral. But we want NGOs or academic institutions to work together with governments to set up the information system that will capture that kind of data. While we are also still thinking of how we can make sure that it's aligned to the other data management system so that it's captured routinely, but we have to still pilot it. We pilot it, we see how it can be done in that district and see how it can be synchronized. If it works, then it can be scaled up, like I said. But the pilot has to be done by an academic institution, you know, through a partnership with government, with an NGO. Then we gather the data, and then we can learn from it. We will learn from the data management. We'll learn from the outcomes of surgical care. And then we can scale up that.
Thank you so much for all of those great points that you've mentioned. One of the things that you mentioned during your talk is that we do lots of talking in global surgery, but little action, which we sort of agree with you. And so based on that, we're going to shift gears a little bit to talk a bit of a broader discussion around global surgery itself. And so the question to you is sort of two-sided, but first of all, what is your definition of global surgery? I mean, we all know what global surgery is, academically speaking, and we have the definition, but to you personally, how would you define global surgery? And then the other part of it is, do you think that our sort of understanding of global surgery has neo-colonialistic impressions or reflections sometimes? What are your thoughts on both of these aspects?
Okay, so global surgery for us is a field of work, is an area of work that is multi-sectoral, multidisciplinary, and has a lot of partners, multi-stakeholder. The field is relatively new because it's the first time we're bringing different components and pieces and stakeholders together. But overall, the goal of global surgery is to try and have universal access to surgical healthcare by the definition of universal healthcare. So it's access to quality health services or surgical services, you know, without having to undergo catastrophic, you know, costs for those that need it. So everybody who needs surgery should have it of good quality without them incurring very, very huge costs that are impoverishing. Now, to achieve that goal, there are specific components, one of them being advocacy and global health diplomacy. We need to advocate to ourselves, to the patient, to the stakeholders about this challenge and how to improve it. And then there is policy formulation and analysis. We need to create new surgical or health policy that covers surgery that are integrated, you know what I'm saying? Like the National Surgical Obstetric Anesthesia Plan, or it could be what the WHO is framing as ecosystems, emergency care, critical care, and operative care. The names doesn't matter. Countries can even change the names of the policy. Nigeria called it something else. Malawi is calling it something else. But the key thing is that it's a surgical policy and surgical in its totality. When I talk surgery, I'm including anesthesia. I'm including emergency care. I'm including critical care. I'm including obstetric care. I'm including palliative care. But I'll just say surgical health care. So there's need to formulate policies that takes care of the full picture. And where it's formulated, there is need to analyze it, how it's really functioning. Like the Zambian policy was developed, 5 years have gone by. We need to critique, we need to analyze it and see how we can improve it. All that is still part of global surgery. Then there's a component of service delivery, which is a key component. Because all this diplomacy and advocacy and policy should be aiming to provide the surgical service itself. So we cannot just be in board meetings, in flights, on Zoom, talking, when the patients are still not receiving anything. So there's a component of delivering the actual service to the people. Again, there we need equipment, we need infrastructure, we need supplies, we need human resources, we need information to be gathered. The last part being the research, the operative research part. We need to continue to do research to inform policy, to improve our service, to improve anything, even our advocacy. everything we do should be evidence-based and should be seen to be something that's working. So in global surgery, which is a new field for me, the goal being universal health coverage to surgical services, the activities being advocacy and global health diplomacy, we have to be diplomatic. Formulation of health policy, surgical health policy, and its analysis, service delivery of surgical services for those that most need it, especially the district and the rural areas. And then, of course, operation research that should critique and justify what we're doing and everything else. So for me, that's what global surgery is.
That's great, because I find, you know, even you just defining the term global surgery, the definition that I know it, academically speaking, is very different from the definition that you just described, because yours is more dynamic. It's more a working definition that is translatable to the ground, to actionable items, whereas the definition of global surgery that is, for example, very popular or that we know in academic literature feels to me like it's more academic. That's all. That's the best way I can describe it. And this is one of the reasons why we wanted to have these conversations with people like you, is because, again, going back to the point of neocolonialism in global surgery and public health, I know this has been on the agenda in so many conversations in public health and in global surgery as well. What are your opinions about neocolonialism and global surgery? You know, one of the examples being the definition of global surgery. Whose definition is it? Who's this definition for? Is it truly for people on the ground in LMICs, or is it only for academic circles in global surgery in higher income countries or in conferences, et cetera, et cetera? What do you think about that?
So the way we approach issues in global surgery is very different from us who are in the low middle income countries and on the ground and in the front line. And for those that are from New York or Chicago or Vancouver, in the West, you like to define everything. You like to define it, the definition, and then, you know, you do a lot of, you do a lot of that. In Africa or in the developing world, we want more practical stuff. We don't care the theory, you know what I'm saying? We just want something that works. So we are more practical oriented and we care less about the definition, you know what I'm saying? But when we apply this to neocolonialism and that, look, global surgery is not happening in a vacuum. We are human beings. We've been in existence in this planet. We've had trends. We've had stereotypes, we've had approaches to things. There was international health before that, there was global health before that, before, you know, global surgery is part of global health, basically. At least that's how we look at it. So it would be wrong for me to say that there's no neocolonial components in global surgery, because there are human beings involved and they're coming from different parts of the world. And usually the need is more in the developing countries, and the people mostly trying to help are those coming from developed countries. They can't help coming with their burden. You know, we call it katundu, their burden. You know, there's this stuff that they carry, attitudes that they carry from where they grew up, from the neighborhood. It's a lot of different things. So we don't expect them, just because they've joined and want to work and help out in global stage, that they all of a sudden they'll forget about their attitude or, you know, their approach. No, they can't. They're human beings. They'll carry that baggage with them. At the same time, we can't say that it's all totally just, you know, infiltrated and polluted with that kind of attitude. No, that's not true. There are people who are genuinely wanting to help and they don't impose anything on you. And, you know, they want you to speak and take, you know, they really encourage the developing world or the marginalized communities to actually have a say. But even then, even when that is encouraged a lot, it's also the pace of things. In the Western world, you are like, you know, you're on the move. You're so busy. You have no time for yourselves. We have so much time, even in the middle of problems. We like to chill. We like to relax. We take our time. We don't look at the watch. We look at the sun to guide us on what we do. So we say, let's meet in the evening. We don't say, oh, let's meet at 7. No, no, no. We say, let's meet in the evening. So our approach and our attitudes is very different. It's more relaxed. So when we try to work together, the Western world and the developing world or Africa, obviously there will be frustrations. Like I said, there are those that are going to come with their baggage. And then they'll meet me, who says, let's meet in the evening, not at 7. And because they want things to happen, they may have the bad part of theirs, them can come out if they're frustrated. There's a situation that will force such things to come through. What we should actually do is not so much to play the blame game and point fingers, oh, you're always neo-colonial. I think you really want to help for you to even be interested. But even when you help, again, we should understand human nature. We help people because we want to feel good ourselves. It's never really up just for the other person. When you help, you feel good. When you insult somebody, you feel the pain yourself because you hear the insult. It will have an impact on you. When you get pissed with somebody, it's not only the other person who's being bashed with all the bad words that gets the, you will feel as much. It's natural, it's a natural law for every action. There's an equal and opposite reaction. So what we need to do is understand that these things are there. And when they do show their faces, we use global health diplomacy to engage, to make the others aware of how we feel about their approach or their attitude. We may be too slow for you. How are you going to tell us? You can't just keep quiet. Oh, these Africans, my God. You can't even speak your mind. It shouldn't be like that. If I'm too slow for you, say, okay, look, you have to sit me down and explain nicely how you feel about it. So these things are there and they will arise many times. What matters is when they do arise, intentionally or unintentionally, can we deal with them in a diplomatic, nice way? Really still keeping the focus that we really want to work together and we want to serve or solve a common good. Even if the problem is here, when you are involved in it, you are learning something and there'll be other benefits, even feel good. You feel good when you do something for the poor. So it's not just for us. You're not just doing for us, the poor African. No, you are learning something. And there's a lot of opportunities too that we talk about in global surgery. When it comes to service delivery, there you may struggle to, you may not see in certain cases and certain conditions or even just have the skill. Here, we let you do the stuff. We won't stop you. You get your hands dirty. So you can learn more, you can be exposed to more pathology. There's always benefits. So it's a mutually beneficial engagement. There will be challenges. It's like marriage or a relationship. It's never rosy all the time. Those who think it's rosy, well, let them see when they get involved. Yeah.
I love all of that. And I think I love how you transform like this clash into a marriage. And I think it should be your marriage. But talking about marriages, almost all global health and global surgery graduate programs, maybe except the exception is the University of Cape Town, that's the only one I know of, are hosted in academic institutions in high-income countries, so in Western countries. And you yourself, you did an MPH in one of those programs, and we have one here at UBC, a Master's in Global Surgical Care. I'm wondering, you know, how can these programs be helpful for people like you, for surgical leaders in the developing world, and how can we actually make this marriage work? Or should these programs actually not migrate and be hosted in institutions in the LMICs? I feel like there's kind of a disconnect here between, you know, us trying to empower LMICs in sub-Saharan Africa to develop surgical care through graduate programs that are extremely costly and hosted in big academic institutions in Northern America or Europe. What are your thoughts on that?
So I think the solution to that, well, you can't help that you have those centers. You have the resources. You have the resources, all of them, financial resources, human resources. Even your programs are always very innovative. They're always changing. They're always looking at what's needed. The universities function very, very well. In Africa, like I said, we have limited resources, human resources, financial resources. Even our universities sometimes, you know, it takes time. And what they have really is like training for basic. All they want is to train surgeons. When you go a little bit beyond, like, they really don't see how it's really going to help them. So the solution is not so much that we should migrate those programs from there to here or move the people who are trying to do something here to there. No, I think that for global surgery programs there and here to really function, there's need for through twinning or partnership. A program like yours should have centers that are legally arranged. So you should have an MOU with us here. You know what I'm saying? You can have MOUs with a program or even just a facility or a province For example, I'm working at the University Teaching Hospital, which is the top hospital in the country. I'm in the Department of Surgery. We could forge a relationship between your program and this facility. So we could always benefit if in terms of discussions, exchange of teachers, we could do Zoom like now, we could do things together. So we are addressing the problem together, because when you are there, really, what are you working on? Where? Maybe I know that you have pockets of poverty in the developing world, but maybe you should solve those problems too. But partnering is good because it will create the platform where both camps can bring to the table what they have. We'll bring all the patients and all the challenges. You can bring some of your capacities. And then we can also teach you on some things that we know can work here. So both camps, your program, our people, our facility benefit, and especially the patient that we all are talking about can benefit. So we shouldn't just do research on the patients and they receive nothing. We should do research when we have saved them. So this kind of partnership could ensure that when you publish a paper in Canada, you'll be publishing with support and collaboration from people here, and we'll be publishing on work that we've done on the real people here that have benefited from it. I think that's the only way I can say it. It has to be partnership, and partnership where there's a chance to give others a chance to speak. Not just because you come with the money, then you tell everybody what to do. Africa is very different, by the way. That can never work in Africa anymore. So bring to the table whatever resources and whatever material you have. We have a lot that we can bring to the table too, and then let's partner together, and then we can support it. At least your fellows and everybody else working there will actually have a site and a place they can come to if they want. They can work remotely if they want. But that way, the academic program will actually be supported.
I was hoping you'd say that. So you'll get an MOU in the mail soon. I hope you'll sign it.
Sure, that'll be good.
But I agree. I think these programs will only be beneficial if we do twinning and partnerships, because we can offer some piece of research and support in terms of like data collection analysis. We need the discussion on the ground about the problems because we don't have that knowledge at all. So thank you for offering that. And I do believe that there's a role for both. I don't think our programs are useless. I think we can work together to make them even more useful.
Yeah.
I'll hand it over to Reem now.
Yeah, so honestly, this is a great conversation, and I feel like we could talk to you for hours and hours about a lot of questions that we have within global surgery and collaborative efforts. To wrap up our podcast episode, we wanted to ask you a couple more questions. If you had to choose one actionable item to offer our listeners and us in this podcast today to do within the sphere of global surgery that you think might make an impact. So something that we can do individually today that might help patients, advocacy, whatever you think in your opinion that would be very effective in the global surgery sphere, what would it be?
I think the thing that would be most effective is to look for an opportunity where you can directly impact a patient. You have to find a way individually or as a group where you can impact the surgical patients somewhere in the world. It could be in your country. It could be in a community where they are marginalized and not receiving this service. It could be outside. Yes, there's travel restrictions and everything else, but it's still very possible. See how you can find a way to impact even just one patient so they can receive the surgical health care that they deserve. It may be educating them. It may be guiding them to where they can get it. It may be supporting those that are on the ground to actually provide this service. If we all can really look at being able to impact one person, even in the whole year, just one person, so they receive the surgical care that they need, I think we'll be moving in the right direction. Everything else is meaningless until we can have impact and really help someone.
We couldn't have said it better. This is perfect, because we always need to shift our focus again and again and remind ourselves why we're doing this. We're doing this for our patients. We're not doing this for our publications. We're not doing this for our CV. We're doing this for our patients at the end of the day. We couldn't have said it better.
The other things are bonus points. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. If you were to recommend one person or someone that we should interview on this podcast on our next episodes, who would you suggest?
There are many people that you could interview. There is Professor Emmanuel Eme, who's in Nigeria, working in children's surgery. You could talk to Professor Abebe Bekele, who's the dean of the School of Medicine in Rwanda, but is from Ethiopia. He works with COSEXA, is the head of the academic programs in COSEXA. So he had a lot of knowledge on the regional level, at country level in Rwanda and in Ethiopia. You could talk to colleagues in South Africa, Martin Smith from WITS, is the head of department surgery. And you could also talk to people in the West. There's John Mira at PGSSC. You can talk to David Waters in Australia, working with the Pacific Islands. You could talk to Terry Reynolds, who's the head of department in WHO, looking at surgery, so you can hear the perspective of WHO and how they want to carry this work forward. So there's a lot of people that you could talk to.
Perfect. We will use those recommendations and contact these guests. Thank you so much for coming onto our episode today. We appreciate your time and this wonderful conversation.
Thank you so much.
Take care, Emmanuel. Really lovely to see you. Have a good day.
Thank you for listening to Off the Table, a global surgery podcast. Make sure to follow us on your favorite podcasting app and leave us a review. You can also find show notes and more information about past and future episodes on our website, www.patreon.com/offthetablepodcast. If you have comments or suggestions, you can email us at offthetablepod21@gmail.com or connect with us on Instagram, OTT_global surgery, and Twitter, offthetable_pod. We hope that you join us on our next episode.